The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. This is a mini edition of the podcast dedicated to an extended interview with the British scientist Mark Pagel. Pagel is a fellow of the Royal Society and a professor of evolutionary biology, heading the Evolutionary Laboratory at the University of Reading. His latest book is called Wired for Culture: Origins of the Human Social Mind. It explores the evolutionary structure of culture and how this evolution is analogous to the evolution of human biology. So it was with great delight that I met with Mark to discuss his book, Wired for Culture. So Mark, thank you for coming in. Your book deals with the scientific inquiry into the roots of culture. Now, we think of culture as a result of consciousness, of language, of interaction between people and maybe high art, opera, all those sorts of things. But you think that perhaps actually we've got this the other way, wrong way around, that actually culture is what makes us like this in the first place.
Yes, I mean, most people, when they think of culture, they think of high art and opera and symphonies and so on. But really, these are the sort of outpourings of culture. And what we have to call people's attention to is that sometime around 160,000 years ago, humans invented a unique capacity to share ideas and skills and technology from one mind to another. And this created a new form of evolution on the planet, a form of evolution in which ideas could now evolve. And this was such a prosperous way of living because now human societies could adapt to their environments much more rapidly than their genes could, that this new cultural evolution propelled people around the world. And so if we want to look to human nature, we need to look to the adaptations that we have acquired in response to living in this very prosperous social environment, rather than looking to our kind of shared history with the other animals. And so in many ways, what we think of as culture is the outpourings of this great sphere of evolution, this evolution of ideas.
So let's go back to the evolution of the human, or the early ancestors of humans. For billions of years on the planet, it was the genes, it was DNA that really drove what survived and what didn't survive. If you happen to have a genetic advantage in some particular environment, then you survived, or you're more likely to survive than something else, and you're in competition with other members of your species to sort of and then that's how evolution is driven forwards. And so you've mentioned 160,000 years ago. Tell us what actually happened at that point that we started to do something different, or
yes,
not we, but consciously, but it just started to happen.
Yes, you're exactly right. For the first 3.5 billion years or so of life on Earth, genes ruled and species adapted by the gradual and successive accumulation of genetic changes. And then sometime around 160 to 200,000 years ago, modern humans arose. And we can really date the arrival of modern humans by the presence in the fossil record of a flourishing of artifacts, things that we make. And what this tells us, because all humans alive today share this, is that sometime around the origin of our species, we acquired the ability to teach each other, to learn from each other, to observe each other, performing new and novel skills. And it was this new form, this new sphere of evolution that could now progress far more rapidly than genetic change. Now a society could walk into a new area, like into a desert region, and they could learn at the cultural level or adapt at the cultural level how to live in that environment, rather than having to wait for the much slower process of genetic evolution.
And this is how you contend that we spread throughout the entire world and occupied as many niches as almost as bacteria do.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the defining features of most animals is that they're confined to the regions of the world that their genes adapt them to. So today we find chimpanzees in a very small region of Western Africa, and that's the region of the world their genes adapt them to. Same thing for all of the other species of the world. Except when you look at humans, and in an odd, peculiar sort of way, we've moved out of Africa and occupied all of the environments on Earth, almost as if we're separate biological species. That's how well we've been able, as a single species, to adapt to all these different environments. And I have mentioned that in a sense, this is a characteristic we share with the bacteria, although even the bacteria, in occupying all of these various environments on Earth, they're different biological species of bacteria. We, as a single coalition of genes, a single genome that all humans carry, and we can all happily interbreed with each other, yet we've been able to adapt at the cultural level to every environment on Earth.
This is the idea, the flourishing of ideas between different people, sharing ideas, cooperation, living in larger and larger groups. Would you say that's an inevitable part of what happens if you do live in societies that are hundreds or thousands of people rather than just small sort of gangs in the middle of the forest?
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things about humans is that we've shown that cooperation as a strategy can frequently triumph over conflict. And so we often summarize Darwinian evolution as nature red in tooth and claw or survival of the fittest. And this sounds like genetic evolution is all about the nastiest and most selfish strategies. But one of the things that human evolution in particular teaches us is that cooperation as a strategy often can return more to individuals than can the selfish or nasty strategies. And there's this wonderful balance in human nature between highly ultra-social tendencies. We have this tendency to help each other out, to cooperate with each other, to contribute to charities, to hold doors for people, to do philanthropic acts, maybe even to die in wars. And yet, on the other hand, we have to balance that against the obvious other side of our nature that we know can be highly violent and xenophobic. And both of these tendencies arise out of this occupation of the world by these small tribal societies that were adapting to their environments in competition with other human groups trying to do the same. Now, one of the wonderful things about human evolution is that we can see that over the last 10,000 years or so, there has indeed been this trend for cooperative strategies to beat competitive ones. And so our nature was to evolve in small tribal societies of maybe 500 people, but those rather quickly gave way by about 10,000 years ago to societies that were called chiefdoms, and then those gave way to city-states and nation-states. And we now see the highest levels of cooperation at the level of states or even supra-state organizations like the European Union or the EU. And what these do is rope together formerly competing entities in cooperative frameworks that seem to return more to everyone than constant cycles of betrayal and revenge.
Steven Pinker, the celebrated psychologist, came out with a book last year, actually, where he talked about how human violence has declined over the last however many hundreds of thousands of years. A few hundred, or maybe a thousand years ago, you're very likely to have your head caved in by a spade or something, and no one would notice, whereas it's really quite unlikely now. Does that go along with the idea that cooperation is something important, or is there something to say there that actually we are violent inherently, but we somehow started to overcome these things through shared sort of mutual consideration?
You know, it's really both. We are violent by nature, and we're cooperative by nature. Both of these tendencies inhere in all of us. What's happened over the last 10,000 years or so, and really it's been growing throughout most of our history, but has really taken off in the last 10,000 years or so, is that we've been domesticated increasingly by our cultural groups. Our cultural groups reward cooperation over competition. And so those of us with the most violent tendencies, and we all vary in all of these things, those of us with the most violent tendencies increasingly are put to the margins of society. We're put in jails, we're fined, we're kept away from other people. And from a Darwinian perspective, we can say it's simply harder to reproduce when you're put on the margins of society. There's actually selection against violence in our societies now. Even though there's still lots of violence in them, there's selection against it. And so we have been tamed by our own cooperative instincts, not because cooperation is nice or it's good to be cooperative, but because that has returned more for our survival and reproduction as a strategy than has competition over this last 10,000 years.
So biological determinism is contained in our genes, we know that. That they contain the programs, essentially, to create a person and in a physical sense. If culture is this idea that you suggest, which also has an important evolutionary responsibility, then where does that sit? Is there a specific bit of the brain? Is there a set of neurons? Where does it sit, and how does it transmit itself?
It's a lovely question, because we need to think of our cultures as just another way of transmitting information down the generations, just as our genes do. Now, the genetic information resides in our genes and gets passed on from our parents to their offspring. Our cultural information resides in our minds. You could say it's encoded in our mind somehow. That's where that information resides. We have genetic predispositions to make use of that cultural information. Those are our adaptations to culture. And those bits of cultural information have been selected throughout the ages by our minds to be the pieces of information that are useful to us. And so it shouldn't surprise us that most of the things in our lives, our bicycles and our toasters and our computers, these are all culturally evolved artifacts, and they're extraordinarily useful to us. And so that's where that information resides, and we should treat it as an evolving Darwinian entity, just as we treat our genes, and just as we've come to accept that our genes have evolved to promote our reproductive interests, we need to start seeing culture as an evolved corpus or entity that has also evolved to promote our genetic interests. And it's probably been the single most important trait that's ever existed in the history of the world for converting new lands and resources into more people. It's become our species' strategy for promoting its genes.
I guess there's another thing you can say about culture, is that as well as looking at it from that point of view, that it creates more human beings. I mean, ultimately, that's what genetics is all about. It's a way for DNA to find copies of itself, essentially. Is it true also that culture has given us the cognitive abilities to find out about the universe, for example? And I mean, one person could not have done that by themselves, but hundreds of years of physics research, for example, gets you to, you know, what's inside protons. One person individually could never do that, but through the transmission of culture through books and knowledge. Does that sort of fit with your analogy, or is that a different thing?
Nothing in the evolution of our cultures was looking to explain the universe. And so we can say that in some sense, our ability to explain the universe, or to explain it as well as we do, is a byproduct of cultural evolution.
And it's a bit like opera.
A little bit like opera. But what might that byproduct be? What we do know is that culture evolves and progresses by a slow, successive accumulation of ideas, one on top of the other. We seem to have this ability to understand cause and effect, to realize that things happen and they lead to outcomes. We seem to have hardwired into our brains a desire to be able to predict outcomes. And these are all things we would expect of an intelligent organism. And so, in some sense, our science is a sort of natural outgrowth of a mind that has evolved to try to understand, in particular, what other individuals in its environment are about to do. It's extraordinarily important for a socially oriented, culturally oriented species to have theories about what other people are about to do. And I would suggest that much of our desire to understand the world is an outgrowth of this desire to be able to control our environment, to predict it, and thus respond to it almost in an anticipatory way so that it doesn't get the better of us.
Now, in such a short space of time, we've had a huge cultural evolution from 200,000 years ago to now. What constitutes a good idea, or a good gene, if you like, a cultural gene? And how do we mitigate or prevent bad ones from spreading around?
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things about cultural evolution is that the ideas themselves don't really have your interests in mind or my interests in mind. And so there's this constant conflict between what I want in my brain as best for me in promoting my survival and reproduction, how to find my way to the dentist or something like that, versus advertising jingles that I can't get out of my mind. Now, both of those are culturally evolved ideas. So what constitutes a good idea? Well, from the perspective of the idea itself, its transmission rate constitutes a good idea. From our perspective, what constitutes a good idea is an idea that can somehow promote our survival and reproduction. And I think one of the most extraordinary things about human culture is that once we acquired the ability to have culture, to have ideas, to somehow free ourselves from the control of our genes, you might have thought that we would have gone down the route of frivolous hedonism or profligate spending or reckless drug abuse or promiscuous sexual activity. And we do all those things, but the remarkable thing is how little we do them. Most of the things we do and most aspects of our culture are finely tuned to promote our interests. And so good ideas from our perspective are ones that promote our interests. And we seem to have good filters for recognizing what those are and good immune systems for avoiding the bad ones.
I was going to say, you talk about something called a cultural immune system. Take us through what that is.
Yes, I mean, we know that we have an evolving Darwinian system in the form of our immune systems, our genetic immune systems within our bodies.
And
that attack viruses and bacteria and so on. And the only reason we can keep up with those viruses and bacteria that can evolve millions of times faster than we can is we have this real-time evolving Darwinian immune system inside our bodies. Well, I suggest that in any organism that has evolved to acquire culture and to use ideas, that we also have a cognitive immune system whirring away inside our minds, checking all of the ideas that are coming into our minds and asking of those ideas, are they good ideas? Are they bad ideas? If they're bad ideas, maybe putting up a little flag for other parts of our brain to grab a hold of them and take them away and bury them somewhere so that we don't be controlled by them. And so I think it's reasonable to expect that what we might call our good judgment is this constantly evolving cognitive Darwinian system in which our minds are awash with defensive ideas that are just looking for things that might take advantage of us and lead us down the path of sort of feckless behavior or profligate or hedonistic behavior.
How quickly is this is the rate of this cultural evolution changing? I mean, has it stayed the same in the past, and will it stay the same in the future? I mean, I can't help thinking that the fact that we're all able to communicate with each other much, much more effectively now than we were even 20 years ago means that ideas spread faster.
That's exactly right. I mean, culture itself is the crucible for its own sort of creativity, because culture is all about learning and copying from others. And the more things that we have produced in our cultural environment, the more things there are that we can look at and combine with other things, put ideas together. And now with the internet and telecommunications, we can see ideas popping up all over the world. And so in a sense, our cultural minds now have a sort of collective intelligence of everyone on Earth, whereas only 10,000 years ago, our minds might have had access to a sort of shared store of knowledge of the 50 or 100 people in our tribe. Cultural evolution in those days would have been rather slow, but it has been progressively speeding up throughout our evolution or throughout our history, so that now it's evolving at a pace that no one can keep up with, and it's causing us some troubles. So for example, we've evolved the ability really to control the world. We're driving around in our automobiles, and we all love those cars, but we're polluting the earth. And in some sense, our cultural evolution there has got way ahead of our ability to recognize that we're creating a world we can no longer live in.
And we recognize it, we just don't want to do anything about it, it seems.
None of us should be surprised that our genes evolved ruthlessly to promote our interests, so did our culture. And so it shouldn't surprise us that our cultures are just as greedy and acquisitive as our genes are. And in some sense now, our cultures have run away with us. And so it's going to take an enormous change in our thinking to be able to somehow slow down that greedy and acquisitive nature. And don't forget that cooperation has returned a lot for our genes. It's a greedy and acquisitive strategy.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all we have for you this week. Science Weekly will be taking a very short break, and the reason for that is that we're preparing for a very, very special edition of the show. Science Weekly Live will take place on March the 28th at the Royal Institution here in London. Tickets for the show, which will be taking place in the prestigious Faraday Lecture Theatre, are free and available by going to rigb.org. So until then, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.